Our charter was to assess the compliance with the CABE intent. We had the CABE report provided to us. They had specific wording in there. We did have our own interpretation of that CABE intent. In this specific instance, it says the program, this is CABE wording, the program should determine the actual impact resistance of current materials and the effect of likely debris strikes. And they have not been able to affect that yet with ICE. That's why I'm saying it. I'm not trying to take away from the achievements that have been made here by NASA, but there is a lot of very significant open work that was not able to be completed and may not be completed by return to flight. And I think that we need to reflect that in our deliberations and in our final report on this recommendation because in essence, they have met the CABE intent and the wording in part, but they have not met it in full.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that we've discussed this enough. There is a plan, again, that they're following to close out these items, these open items. I have no objections to wordings that Susan just mentioned. And I think we ought to go with that as a task force recommendation. But the tech panel still stands with the fact that we believe it met the intent of the CABE recommendation. So with that in mind, let's take the task force agreement that there's more work to be done, including the RCC hardening, and let's go with her words and go forward.
We know this is where the tech panel was. They believe the open work, which is really the key thing here, other than the side issue in my mind of the RCC long-term plan, but open work, you believe, is covered adequately this way, but because there are other people that feel it's significant enough and it's non-standard, that we can document that as we have not been able to show through, we haven't demonstrated the full intent's been met because of that open work. Is that right?
That's right.
Any other discussion relative to that? Si, you okay with that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, then again, unless someone has an objection, I recommend that based on the closure package submitted by NASA, the technical panel's presentation, our deliberation, which modified the recommendation and the assessment, will reflect that NASA has met in part the intent of CABE recommendation 332, but has not fully demonstrated that it has met all of the intent based upon open work and the lack of a long-term program to enhance RCC.
Ready to go to the second part.
Okay.
We got Dick Kors, who's going to talk about the external tank debris shedding.
Next chart, please, 45. This is a CIB recommendation, which was initiate an aggressive program to eliminate all external tank TPS debris shedding at the source, with particular emphasis on the bipod strut attached to the external tank. The thing I'd point out here is that the CABE didn't address ICE. They just addressed the thermal protection system and basically the foam. Next chart, let me back up one first. What the ET program did, or the program overall, they broke this into three phases. The first phase was to worry about return to flight, STS-114. The second phase was additional process improvements that they could implement in line for the rest of the remaining tanks. And the third phase was really trying to approach the all part of this recommendation. And the all part of this is kind of like the RCC we just discussed. The tank did a study on how they would eliminate the feed lines, how they would maybe even rotate the tank 180 degrees to get the feed line on the other side. And it turned out with the announcement that the shuttle was going to stop flying in 2010, it just exceeded the schedule capability to go to phase three. So phase three, if you read the literature in the NASA literature and in our report, phase three was dropped about probably 6 months into the, or just after the announcement to stop the shuttle flying in 2010. So the program took the first phase, which they turned into, next chart please, to eliminate all sources of critical debris, including eliminating the bipod strut foam. And our group here adopted this approach to eliminate all sources of critical debris for the return to flight. Next chart is just a high-level summary of what the ET tank has done over the last 2 years. They developed new TPS debris requirements in conjunction with the program office. TPS hardware designs were verified through a rigorous design verification review. Hardware did not meet the return to flight TPS debris requirements. Using this new design verification approach, we're redesigned, and I'll show you later the areas that were redesigned. And all these reviews went through a series of preliminary design reviews, critical design reviews, and then program level design certification reviews. And then they came up with previously applied foam that was not addressed in return to flight. There were some limitations associated with the ability to certify this non-redesigned TPS application. So the program came up and was accepted by the ET project came up and was accepted by the program, a limitations document that says, here's our rationale why this TPS is okay to fly. And this documentation was just submitted and approved through the normal program control system. And as Cy mentioned back in April, and by the way, there was no really ICE requirements set on the program. What happened is that the program took the ICE data and did an assessment of transport analysis, and as Cy discussed, the probabilistic analysis. And when they came back to the Delta DVR on April 27th, the program decided that the risk was too high for the forward bellows, so the program re-baselined or made a change to the requirements to include a heater system at the forward bellows to eliminate ICE. So this is a high level of what went over the last couple years. Next chart is just quickly to show you the changes that were made to the tank hardware-wise. If you start about 2 o'clock, that is a major redesign of the bipod fitting, and the bipod ramp is what came off on STS 107, and basically that ramp on either side is gone, and the bipod now has a clear fitting, but it has a heater installed at the base to ward off any ice. 4 o'clock, to stop the divoting in the inner tank, a series of pre-drilled holes were applied in the area of the arbiter, the area facing the arbiter. 6 o'clock was a LH2 PEL ramp was removed primarily so they could fix the LH2 inner tank flange, which was over at 9 o'clock, but to fix that flange, which is like plus or minus, I think it was 120 degrees on each side of the axis facing the arbiter, that was replaced, and the bolts were turned around, the new spray foam applications and new processes were used to finish off that. And then 11 o'clock up on the top was the aft longeron closeouts, which they determined in some of the dissection of existing tanks that they had some voids, so they went in and used a new application and process to replace that foam on the longeron closeouts. And then at 12 o'clock is a photo of the forward bellows, and that's the area that to mitigate ice, the TPS drip lip was installed, which reduced the ice about 40%, and then basically based on the DVR, the initial DVR, the program decided to put heaters on that forward bellows. So this is kind of the overall hardware changes that were made to the ET. Next chart. This is the debris certification verification results. It shows the areas coming down the tank from top to bottom. If you look at the third column from the right, where it says debris requirements, these are the requirements that the program put on the ET, and these are the requirements that were used to go through the rigorous certification process. And coming out of the DCR, the ET project says, hey, we've demonstrated that we've met these requirements. In addition, the tank was asked later on, if you look at the third column from the right, where it says debris requirements, these are the requirements that the program put on the ET, and these are the requirements that were used to go through the rigorous certification process. And coming out of the DCR, the ET project says, hey, we've demonstrated that we've met these requirements. In addition, the tank was asked later on to provide their best estimate of the max possible mass that would come off the ET, and that's the second column from the right, and they used a safety factor of 125 in this application. And you see the values are pretty significantly reduced in some cases, like 023 to 0.003 up on the top line. And basically then the line on the right is the margin of safety that the ET demonstrated against the debris requirement based on what they think is the mass expected. The mass expected was based on test data, dissection data, and special test. This deals with the foam coming off. The next chart then deals with ice here again coming down the side of the tank. I can't read these numbers from here, but basically on the right-hand column, it shows you the amount of ice in terms of mass coming off that potentially from these various areas coming down on the fittings. And if you look at the second one from the bottom, this is the area when they presented it to the program control board, they said, hey, we need to do some mitigation, so we're going to put a heater on that. And the 06 number, after they put the heater on, I think was reduced to 0.013 and is considered now not really a debris source. So the next chart, these are just some pictures. It says the baseline on previous flights at this temperature and humidity, you were getting pretty significant amounts of ice, and these are pictures based on test data at Marshall. The middle one is where they added this drip lip that comes down around the side, and basically the reduction was approximately 40%. And then on the right side is the heater application that was applied to the second tank that was at the Cape and will be applied to all future tanks. And this configuration is creating a little bit of ice, but based on the tanking test, our test they've done at Marshall, they feel that will be acceptable. This will be an area that will be closely monitored again at by the ice team at the Cape as Cy addressed it, as well as looking at the umbilicals on the arbiter. The next chart is our panel assessment. We broke this up into foam and then for ice, but for foam, as I mentioned, the ET did demonstrate that they met the program requirements at their DCR. After the DCR, the program determined that the requirements exceeded the arbiter capability in some cases, and Cy showed you where the cases were where they didn't meet the capability. I mentioned ET went back and provided the best estimate of expected debris, and I showed that on an earlier chart. And then based on that, the program developed the statistical analysis of risk based on the best estimate of debris from ET and then the debris capability of the arbiter from the arbiter project. And Cy showed you the different allowables for the different parts of the tank and the different parts of the RCC. For ice, like I said, there really was no requirement to start with. It was an analysis of how much ice was there. The ET did move out early a couple years ago on various combinations to solve the bellows ice. I mentioned this drip lip that they came up with, which was a 40% reduction. I mentioned that the program showed this as unacceptable. The ET was replaced, and as I mentioned, the testing has shown that it's minimal ice will be there on launch day. And they also looked at the other ice buildup locations, which Susan and Cy talked about, and have analyzed those and presented the risk associated with the other ice buildup locations. And that's really the statistical analysis, which is on the bottom line.
Hey, Dick, I got a question. I'm going back up to the phone.
Yeah.
The process of developing the best estimate, since that led down to the statistical analysis, how closely were y'all able to look at what they did there?
Well, we looked at the data. It was based on dissection data from other tanks. I think it was ET 94, which was in the factory. And then they really went back and looked at all of the flight history where they had had good photos and developed an estimate of the amount of foam that was coming off. We looked at that data. It looked reasonable to us, you know, in reviewing it. And it's probably, I guess, Cy and the DVR went through the rigor of these independent panels also looking at it and making a judgment that this was really expected best estimate or max expected that they would see on future flights.
So in addition to the technical panel looking at it, there were other independent looks at the process of developing the best estimate?
SC and IO within the program, NESC, have all looked at this.
This data was the data that was fed into the analysis, which was done on the foam, which was done by Aerospace Corporation. And they took all of, by this point in time, they had accepted the flight tanks, and they took all of their lead-in, lead-out panels that they had dissected, which were the representative of the actual flight article, and used all of that data also to give them what their expected void size was.
In a test data, they actually put voids in panels and subjected it to the acid environment in a test cell.
And then the modeler people modeled, based on that data, the actual liberation mechanism and their effects as it went through the flow field.
Right.
For those of you who are at the April design for verification review, I think one of the follow-on actions from there was to do this end-to-end probabilistic for foam cases that didn't meet the factor 51.4 and the best estimate. There were some foam, there were cases, I think probably both RCC and tile, but they were taking a look at those specifically in the best estimate cases where they still hit, you know, even under best estimate there was still an issue of factor safety and capability.
Well, when you get all done with these, with using their risk assessment methodology, they're categorizing these into remote possibilities, improbable, and infrequent. So even, and I think Cy said it, you're still having eliminated critical debris. It's if it does come off the tank, and it has a potential. But from a statistical standpoint, they've categorized them into these likelihoods, which if you look at that matrix chart, it's in the yellow or in the
yellow.
Yeah. Next chart. So our overall panel assessment is that the ET project did implement an aggressive program to eliminate this critical foam debris. Didn't start quite as aggressive on ice. Worked primarily on the bellows drip lip. But I mentioned earlier that these certified tank debris allowables, based on the program requirements, exceed the capability of Arbiter, but not in all cases. And Cy showed you on his chart which cases were there was an exceedance. The best estimate of debris allowables supplied by the ET, as I showed on my chart, are significantly lower than the certified values. And then using those best estimates, you lowered the increased the likelihood of it not happening, or lowered the likelihood of it happening. The SS program office evaluated the foam and ice through these statistical analysis that I mentioned. And then the program, based on this DVR activity, has developed a document which puts all of this material that Cy talked about and all of the material from the ET project and the debris models and documents in a debris generation and impact tolerance requirements, ground rules and assumptions document, in which they fully document the debris generation certification levels and the debris expected risk levels. And this is their cornerstone for for moving forward on flight rationale. So my last statement is even though the program has performed this extensive effort to reduce debris for return to flight, there still is the potential for foam and ice to cause damage to orbiter that exceeds safe entry limits. However, this potential has been significantly reduced. And I think you got to couple this to the analysis that Cy went through. And with that, we come up with our technical team recommendation on the next slide. Is that our panel believes the ET and the program office have demonstrated they have initiated an aggressive program to eliminate ET debris, and within the exceptions and limitations as documented in the NASA document, have met the intent of the CAIB recommendation. And our recommendation is we accept the NASA implementation. And then the other thing, Dick, that I had is I did list an observation here is just as a follow-on work that the program should continue the SSP should continue their program to eliminate critical debris by aggressively working off the limitations documented in this document. And I think that's what the plan is to slowly over the years or over their flights is look at the flight look at the flight data, go back and see where they need to do additional work and work off any limitations that they've defined. So that's our technical team recommendation, and we think they have been very aggressive in eliminating the ET debris.
Thank you very much, Dick. I got two questions, and I'll ask Chuck these questions. Chuck, has NASA cleared the RCC of any ice debris?
NASA has cleared both the RCC of ice debris and foam debris with regard to both from a probabilistic standpoint and a deterministic standpoint, depending on what the liberation source is. They've gone through and identified all of the potential liberation sources, and their first step was to go in and look at the deterministic capability where they compared the cert value at the liberation sort with the cert value at the impact sort. Right. And if it passed that, they did not go further. If it did not pass that, they went off and did a statistical Monte Carlo analysis to assess the risk.
But Joe, it's classified as either
I understand.
Infrequent, remote, or improbable.
I understand that. So that goes into the hazard analysis. The next question is, has the analysis on ice been done for all areas except the ET umbilical?
It's been completed on all areas except the ET umbilical. It has been completed on the forward bellows, on the mid and aft bellows, and on the bracket ice. And the ET umbilical area, as Cy indicated, does not lend itself to the analysis tools that they have. The size of the ice, the mass of the ice is too large, and the velocity of the ice is too small to fit within the analysis tools that the program is currently using.
But here again, in the closure package we received Saturday and again today officially, they have put all of these areas, including umbilical, into a category of infrequent, remote, or improbable. Right. They have categorized it, even though there may be some more work to get.
The program recognizes that they cannot drive the risk of these things to zero. They can only reduce the risk to a level, and they categorize those things within brackets associated with what those risk levels have come out to be.
Okay, thank you.
I'm gonna pick on something here in your recommendation, which here you. You're basing your recommendation that they met the intent K based upon having initiated an aggressive program to eliminate ET debris. Based upon the NASA implementation plan back 2 years ago, or whenever it was, or when it first came out, we took an interpretation, which you presented earlier, that talked about elimination of critical debris, which at the time was the primary hazard, I'll use the right word, hazard control to get us out of an unacceptable risk category was elimination of critical debris. And so I think that's why we picked on, or we chose those words for our interpretation. It's kind of looking at what we thought the agency was interpreting it as, because they talked to critical debris and as eliminating it. Yet here we're going back to the CABE words of initiating an aggressive program to eliminate debris.
Yeah, we're in a little bit of a quandary here, because the CABE said eliminate all. And all, I think the program applied not just to first flight, but applied to subsequent flights, and then the long range phase three, which was dropped. But you're right, we did drop the program's approach back at 2 years ago that says we're going to go after all critical debris. And
we made a mistake.
So in my view, we responded to the CABE recommendation, but our RTF task group interpretation, we're not exactly on it, so we may want to
well, but even this one you've chosen to drop out the all, and so
I dropped the here again the all, because it was downstream, and it's kind of like the RCC discussion. All's probably doable with a lot of money and a lot of time, so
okay, so the all, because of the expiration initiative and the retirement of the shuttle, all became
not doable within the schedule, or overcome by other events.
Okay, now we just talked about where that was maybe a criteria by which the CABE's intent was not met, but. We're in a box here now.
Well, Dick, there's one other thing, and I don't want to muddy the water too much here, but there were a lot of other decisions made in NASA's implementation plan that hinged on this one, and that is, you know, if they felt that, and I think we adopted that interpretation, that we felt that if you could just eliminate the critical debris, which is a subset of all the debris, then if you could certify the tank that you'd eliminated the critical debris, then you could do some other things, like not make mandatory the certification of all of the other repair techniques and the other things down in the risk mitigation matrix. So in the context of the total risk mitigation architecture, this was kind of the linchpin in the risk reduction structure. So. And I think that really came, that thread of continuity came right from the CABE. The CABE says, basically, there are four kinds of, NASA ought to launch a four-pronged attack on this thing. One, eliminate the debris. Two, harden the vehicle so that it can withstand more impact. And three, be able to characterize and identify the debris in flight so that you could analyze what you had and determine the extent of damage if it should happen. And then finally, be able to fix what damage you had left. And all of that represented a risk reduction architecture in the whole. And if you leave the door open a little bit here, then you gotta close it somewhere else. So this is a toughie, because it kind of, to try to figure out what the standalone intent of this recommendation was is difficult, I think. But I think this one misses by just a little, because it leaves the door open. So it may be another one of those partials.
And I agree with Jim on this one. I think it's a little bit different than the prior one we were discussing. But I think in this particular instance, it's a very difficult thing, because the CABE recommendation itself said initiate an aggressive program. Well, they initiated an aggressive program. But that was, you know, two years ago and some ago, and the issue, I think, in our own interpretation was is that since they were already initiating that aggressive program to eliminate all debris shedding, when it was evident that all debris shedding would not be eliminated, it was clearly the focus then became on critical debris. And I think the bottom line, Mr. Chairman, is that ultimately, despite terrific efforts, NASA was not able to eliminate all critical debris. And they can certainly have mitigations and risk acceptance rationales, et cetera. But I think in this particular instance, I possibly could even go so far as say that the CABE intent was not met in this particular instance, but or partial.
My point is that if they didn't say all in the very beginning, they probably would have done a lesser job. Saying doing it all, they fell short just a little. And that's not a bad plan.
I think in all these discussions we're having today, I think the recognition that these are very, very complex, very, very difficult technical issues that NASA's had to deal with, and full credit needs to go to those achievements and the accomplishments that have been made. But our charter, again, was very focused on reporting out on the fulfillment of the CABE intent. And I think when our task group was formed, we put down in our first public report what our interpretation of that CABE intent was. In some instances, there had been some discussion with CABE members trying to get clarifications on CABE intent. And so in fulfillment of the charter, and it sounds a little bureaucratic, but basically that's what we were asked to do, report on NASA's compliance or actions and to fulfill the CABE intent. And that's what we're having to deal with. We've come to this point. There's been great and notable achievements along the way, but you have to go back to, August 2003 when this CABE report was issued and where the CABE was at that time. Not knowing, many of the technical issues that have been, followed along the way over the last 2 years. And so meeting or not meeting the CABE intent is a matter of our comment and our interpretation of that intent and NASA's actions. That does not mean to say that we cannot also comment on the fact that that CABE intent may have not been particularly practicable or practical in this particular environment today, or perhaps that as NASA delved into corrective actions, that they found that the technical challenges were far more than anyone had envisioned, either on the CABE or within NASA at the beginning of all of this.
I like your last two paragraphs, and I agree with you fully on that. But then I also say that there's time to go fly, to go prove what you got. And I think they have taken their steps, all the steps necessary to reduce the amount of debris, and they're really not going to know until they do their flight test, and that's when it becomes the final result.
And that's a key point, is everything that they have done to date, it's impossible on a vehicle the size of the external tank to run a combined environments test, which is the acid test for determining whether or not you've actually been successful in eliminating the generation of debris sources which could be critical to the vehicle. The only way you can do that is fly. There's not the test facility large enough to accomplish that. But admittedly, the program has themselves admitted that they have not, through design, eliminated all critical debris. That was their objective. Their objective was to have a design certification on the tank which overlapped a design certification on the orbiter. They failed to do that, although that was their objective.
And they also did not select the option of redesigning the tank entirely.
Let's see.
The beginning.
Okay, but there were reasons for that. I think, and go back a chart, please. One chart. Look at the bottom bullet here, because that's what I'm looking at. I believe when we look at it and we look at what they've done and what we feel about it, that gets to the point pretty much that although the program has performed an extensive effort to reduce debris for return to flight, there still is a potential for foam and ice to cause damage to the orbiter that exceeds safe entry limits. Basically, it's greater than critical debris. However, this potential has been significantly reduced. If we craft those words around the statement and I might even say that that the potential for critical damage has been significantly reduced by the extensive effort to reduce debris for return to flight. But there still is a potential for foam and ice to cause damage to the orbiter, exceed safety entry limits. And consequently, based on the task group's interpretation of the CAVE recommendation, which is to eliminate critical debris, the intent of the CAVE recommendation wasn't met.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's an accurate statement.
Well, let's see, Dick. I believe that in the executive summary for the closer package that they sent to us, they readily accept that as the position. That is their stated position. See, we do not expect critical foam debris to be liberated. Based on analysis of the debris environment, we are confident that any foam debris liberated during ascent will be small enough so that the TPS will not sustain critical damage. However, we cannot certify that in the worst case scenario, no critical damage will occur. So I think that statement on our assessment is totally consistent with the closeout package that they sent.
It's consistent, I think. And I don't have any problem with what you said, Dick, but we were going back against the CAIB and not to our interpretation, but back to our interpretation, which you said is correct. If you take the word all and say all was downstream and all has been postponed,
But the plan no longer exists for all. Right. If you want to go back to the CAVE interpretation, then there was an aggressive plan to eliminate all.
Yeah.
So the all has gone away and the plan has gone away.
Well, see. I get back to it. We really are, I think everybody's in agreement that what they've done has been appropriate, mm-hmm. and they understand what they have to some degree. There's some uncertainty, and that uncertainty is what means they really haven't eliminated critical debris or all debris, either one, and that our determination that they may not have fully met the intent of CAVE or met the intent of CAVE is almost commentary at this point.
But Mr. Chairman, I think this points up to a certain extent what the program has learned in the last 2 years. They've learned that on this type of vehicle, with the temperatures, the cryogenic temperatures that you're operating to, and the materials that you're using to sustain the propellants on those vehicles, and the ablators that you're using to control the aerodynamic heating, there is, of the very nature of the vehicle, going to be debris which is generated as a function of the vehicle performing its job. And that was the difficulty in many of the statements that were made by the CAVE. The statement all debris negates the fact that there is a natural ablation factor which occurs on all of this material, which constitutes debris. They are booster separation motors that by their very nature produce debris as a part of their functioning on the vehicle. And the program has gone through a very, very exhaustive program to identify every source of debris, including such things as booster separation motor, and to identify whether or not that can be constituted as a critical debris source, and then gone through the process of attempting to liberate. That being said, they have not been successful in that task.
Okay, I guess I'm looking to the technical panel. I understand that the way you guys have interpreted this, have chosen to interpret it for and recommended us is that it be closed with the intent of CAVE having been met, going back to the initiation of an aggressive program to eliminate debris. I sense that there's a few of us that may be a little less accepting of that particular interpretation and feel that real intent based upon the integrated risk assessment and plan was to eliminate critical debris, and that despite the best efforts of the program and the substantial improvements they made that have reduced the risk significantly, they still haven't met that interpretation that we made early on. I guess I'm asking if you guys would consider that assessment by the task group in general.
I'm okay with it, okay. As long as you don't go back and say CAIB recommendation. If you go back and say the
no, task group clearly we would say the task group's interpretation of the CAVE intent. Okay. which is documented and has been documented.
Right. I'm fine with that.
Yep.
But we don't want to change.
No.
Our recommendation.
You just can add another.
I'll.
Good here.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chairman, just for the record, Dan Crippen agrees with what you just said. He basically left a note here saying it does not meet CABE 10 on the debris shedding.
Okay. Dan, unfortunately, had a 4 o'clock hard time, and we didn't find that out until this morning, and we pressed him to a point where he had to depart. Okay, then, do you have something?
No, we're ready to go with the ops panel.
Well, let me say it. Unless anyone has an objection, I recommend that based on the closure package submitted by NASA, the technical panel's presentation, our deliberation, and the revised assessment and recommendation, which basically will say that the intent of the CABE was not met based upon the task group's interpretation of CABE intent. That's how we will record the closure of this recommendation.
Okay, and if the management panel finished first, just to recap, the tech panel is second, and I guess the ops panel is bringing up the rear.
Let's see. I got a point, so we can pace ourselves a little bit. We did get an extension to 5 o'clock. I'm sorry, you guys. it happened. But so we do have 55 minutes to get through this, plus IVASP report out, and to at least get a quick run at any outstanding observations, that personal observations that people may be bringing forward to the task group for inclusion in a report. All right.
Thank you, Dick. I'd like to add my thanks in this being the last meeting, I think. Add my thanks to the co-chairs for their great leadership of this group. It's been an interesting experience and at most times fun.
It's a little late to suck up.
I wouldn't dare do it any earlier. also like to thank, on behalf of the ops panel, thank our esteemed colleagues on the other two panels, tech and management, with whom we've worked extensively throughout this process. It's been an enjoyable experience and enlightening working with such a great bunch of people. And personally, I would like to thank my ops team for the diligent work and hard, long hours and very enlightened opinions and views brought to us all, and putting these responses together. I think couldn't have had a better team to work with, so thank you all from the ops panel. With that having been said, I would like to turn the microphone over to Kathy Thornton, who will be covering 641. Kathy?
Have slide 58, please. This is the CABE recommendation 641, as we've presented several times. You'll notice it's in 4 parts. You'll also notice that, unlike some of the other recommendations, it's very strong. It doesn't have initiate. It has develop. It has accomplish. And this was an extraordinarily challenging recommendation. Next slide, please. It's in 4 parts, 4 separate provisions, and although the entire recommendation was labeled return to flight, there are 2 of them that actually don't really apply to STS 114. One of them applies to non-ISS missions. Since there are none of those on the manifest at the moment, we did not consider that one, although if a non-ISS mission is manifest in the future, like an HSD Service Mission 4, then this recommendation should be revisited. And also, one part of it dealt with a long-term goal of autonomous repair capability, even for station missions. Like RCC hardening and the ET Phase 3 mods, this has been overtaken by events in the announcing the end of life of the shuttle program, so we did not consider that one either. That leaves the remaining 2, and one of them applies to being able to to see and assess damage that might occur to the orbiter TPS, to inspect and be able to locate and understand the extent of that damage. And the last has to deal with actually repairing the damage on orbit. The task group interpretation of that last part, of the first three parts, are pretty clear, but the last part, we interpret it such that any of the repair options in the suite of options must have completed formal design reviews, ground verification testing, procedure development, and an integrated design certification review, such that NASA could implement it in an emergency situation with confidence that it would behave as expected. And that's the bar that we set to distinguish between an experiment and a capability. Next slide, please.
Before we leave that, I feel important that I bring up the fact that that was a contentious interpretation within the panel or the task group, and that there is, at the time that we chose to use that word, that wording, there was a significant minority that believed that the intent of CABE was much less stringent than that, and that was based upon conversations that some of us had had with CABE members in specific relationship to this this recommendation, because of the lack of clarity or severe flexibility, depending upon how you want to look at it, interpretation. And the words that we got from some CABE members was that the real intent was that that the agency do the best that they could in developing repair capabilities and go fly, but to continue to work on what they could bring to bear in the area of repairs. Now, I'll just mention that that was a minority position relative to interpretation. The majority elected this interpretation, which is a standard that we would use for determining whether the intent of the CABE was met or not.
That's correct. And in all the discussions along that, we were never uncertain or had any conflict over what capabilities exist now, what the state of those is. It's just the interpretation of the word capability was the only thing that, that separated the two camps. Next slide, please. In NASA's implementation of inspection, they've developed an extensive suite of sensors to understand the condition of the TPS on orbit. There are will be on-orbit inspection of the wing leading edge and the nose cap with the OBSS. There will be inspection of the acreage tile from the ISS as the orbiter approaches. If there's any indication through the ascent imagery or any other means that there might have been a debris strike, there will be focused inspections of, with higher resolution in the areas that need to be looked at. The imagery capability was covered under the CABE recommendation 343, and we closed that and accepted it at the last plenary. I would like to point out, though, that the sensor suite, at least part of it on the OBSS, is not certified to the level to see the critical damage, but it has been successful in laboratory tests to see damage at that level. It's just beyond the certification. There also will be wing leading edge sensors that are, it's an experimental capability to detect impact on the wing leading edge during ascent, and that will be used to focus inspections. It will not be used to determine whether the damage is critical or not damage, or if there is any damage at all, but it certainly will focus inspections. Next slide, please, 61. There's also an extensive plan to integrate all the data that's gonna be collected from all these various sources, and Christine Fox will cover that later on, so I won't go into that in much detail. But except to say that the plan to integrate all these data is very important, because any decision to implement a repair or to commit to entry with a repair will be extraordinarily difficult. It will be based on all sources of data that are available, with the models, with real-time runs in ArcJet facilities, with flight history, and all that will have to be pulled together in the MMT to make that very difficult decision. That's been demonstrated in numerous integrated component and MMT simulations, the whole process, and Christine will talk about that a little bit more. Next slide, please. 62. This is part of the implementation for tile repair. And before I say that, I want to point out that the orbiter TPS was never intended to be repaired on orbit, and that this recommendation is probably the most technically challenging problem that NASA was given by the CABE. What you'll see in the implementation represents 2 years of intensive effort by a lot of good guys who worked really hard. And this is what they've come up with at this point. They do continue to work on it, and will continue to work on it for the duration of the program. But this is the status right now. And as I said at the last plenary, we have to draw a line in the sand somewhere, and this is where it is, where we make our assessment. The critical damage threshold for tile has been defined as 1 inch in the vicinity of the main landing gear doors and ET umbilical doors, and 3 inches in the major dimension in other acreage tile. There are three options being carried for repair of the tile. The first one is the mittance wash, and that will work on shallow damage anywhere in black tile. And it's something like shoe polish that you put on the damaged sections that restores the emissivity of it, that allows them to radiate more heat. There is a DTO plan for STS-114 on that one. The cure-in-place ablator repair, the SIPA repair, and the material STS-54 is the second of the three. That is intended for a larger and deeper tile damage area, up to 10 by 20 inches anywhere on the tile. There were some toxicity issues with the material in its pre-use configuration. So it's those have been addressed with triple containment while it's in the crew compartment. Once it is the stuff is mixed outside in an EVA environment, it's no longer an issue. So getting it on suits and bringing it back in is not an issue. And so they pretty much addressed that with triple containment. There is a DTO plan for STS-21. 121, there are a number of technical issues, particularly how that material is going to behave in orbit, that need to be tested on orbit in an EVA environment. The third one is sort of a late-breaking one. It came along late in the process. The tile overlay will also be useful for large damage areas up to 10 by 20 inches and deep damage areas. It's a mechanical repair. It's just a cover layer that fits over the hole with some insulation stuff behind it. So that eliminates the variability issues of the material behavior in orbit. It will work for most of the tile areas, except for some of the more highly curved geometries. It's unlikely that it will fit on those. But that has promise for later flights to be an important repair capability. Next slide, please, 63. For RCC, the damage has been, critical damage has been defined by 20 thousandths by 2 inch long crack, or 20 thousandths deep. There are two potential repair options for that. One of them is the NOAX, which is useful for small cracks and small areas of coating loss. That's gone through the preliminary design reviews and interim design reviews. There's also a DTO plan for 114 on that to test the material behavior and also the EVA procedures in orbit. That's been shown to be successful on the ground for cracks up to 65 thousandths. The plug repair is another option for RCC. It's intended to cover holes up to about 4 inches in diameter. It doesn't work on all the RCC. It will only be good for about 62% of it at this time. It's gone through some design reviews as well. There is a DTO plan for 114 that will be done in the crew compartment only. For the plug repair is sort of like a toggle bolt that fits over a hole in the RCC. To work, it has to have a 1 inch hole in which to insert the bolt. There's some issues, I think, with drilling. If you have a hole that happens to be smaller than 1 inch, there's some things that need to be tested on orbit.
Kathy, can they be overlaid for larger holes? I mean, can you, or just a single one time? Yeah,
I think it's one. So that's the two tile RCC repair capabilities. The next slide, please. As part of this implementation, in order to know, you know, when you want to do repairs, whether a damaged condition is used as is, whether it has to be repaired, whether it can be repaired, and whether repair is successful, depends on a lot of these other recommendations being met as well. We have to gather high-quality imagery during the launch and ascent, downlink high-quality imagery of the TPS taken on orbit, possibly access to data from other national assets. All those data will be compared with pre-flight photography to see what the change in the condition of the TPS is. And all this information has to be integrated along with the people who have the expertise to make those kind of decisions in order for this capability to be fully successful. And again, that's Christine is going to talk about the OIP and the implementation for that. Although many of these sources of there are many sources of imagery to understand the condition of the TPS in orbit, none of them are a constraint to launch except the OBSS and the power control system for the pad cameras. Next slide. Our panel assessment in the inspection is that the primary methods to use to inspect on orbit are the OBSS sensor suite and the RBAR pitch maneuver, where the orbiter flips over and the ISS crew takes pictures of the bottom. And those were assessed as part of the task group's evaluation at the last plenary and accepted. The wing leading edge sensor provides some detection capability and was assessed within the context of another recommendation. Next slide. The recommendations that we talked about earlier this afternoon on ET critical debris liberation and the orbiter's ability to sustain damage have sort of raised the temperature on this particular recommendation and made it more important. In terms of risk mitigation, we talk about inspection and repair. Inspection is not in itself a risk mitigator. It just tells you whether you need to go do something else. Damage is, and repair is the more important of those. NASA will carry 5 experimental options that I described earlier to effect emergency repairs over a limited range of damage, although they'll continue to pursue capabilities to repair larger damage areas in the future. The experimental repair operations manifested on 114 show promise for future flights and are contingency measures rather than practicable repair capabilities at this time. Next slide, please. NASA's demonstrated a concerted effort in attacking a very, very difficult problem. Needs to repair a system that was never intended to be repaired. And even though all these repair techniques are considered only for contingency use and only cover a limited range of potential damage, they should go through a rigorous design certification. So if, in fact, they are used, that NASA will fully understand their capabilities. To date, none of these repair techniques have gone through this process. For that reason, that we believe the tile and RCC repair techniques are not considered sufficiently mature to be a practicable repair capability for STS-114. Next slide, please.
Let's see. Use of the word practicable goes back to the CABE's recommendation. Are you trying to tie it to that? Is that that's not a word you'd normally use, Kathy.
Yes, you're right. That was in the CABE recommendation, and that goes, that's sort of, plays into our discussion of what is a capability and what is not a capability and what practicable means. I think our interpretation, the majority interpretation, was something that could be certified, could be used as a practical capability, something that we call hip pockets. You know, you might have an orbit and you might, if you absolutely had to, pull them out and further in real time develop them, and I'm not sure that we would consider those a practicable capability, at least the majority camp. No. As you mentioned, there's some dispute over
there. That's an intriguing word.
Okay, our observations are, once again, that this recommendation represented an extreme technical challenge to NASA, given the physical characteristics of the orbiter TPS. It was never intended to be done. And we acknowledge that there is a gap between the potential debris liberation and the ability of the orbiter to withstand that damage, but we also would like to acknowledge that the proximate cause of the loss of 107 is no longer possible because the bipod ramp is there. So the debris at that level, you know, can happen. The debris damage. Next slide.
And just for clarification, approximate, sort of like practicable. I mean, you mean the absolute physical very
yes.
well bounded cause of the Columbia
That's
accident.
Correct.
It is. We eliminated the foam from the bipod, therefore the bipod ramp does not exist, therefore the foam cannot come off where it does not exist.
But that does not mean that there is not other critical debris liberations
sure.
that could impact.
But that just addresses the point. We, you know, NASA cannot repair damage like Columbia. However, the damage source that caused the Columbia loss cannot happen. And I guess this is the last one. I want to go back to where the recommendation was broken up into two parts we're considering. One was inspection. Inspection was addressed in recommendation 343, and that assessment also meets the intent of this recommendation as far as inspection goes. But based on the majority opinion interpretation of the intent of 641 with regard to repair, that any repair technique must be vetted through design and ground verification processes prior to be considered a capability. None of these options have met that at this point, and so it is the majority opinion that NASA has not met the intent of CABE recommendation 6.4-1 with respect to TPS repair. Has with respect to inspection, but not with respect to repair.
Okay, questions?
I agree with the recommendation, and actually Dan Crippen again had left a message saying I had a proxy, but I know that he also feels that this interpretation is correct. But just for the record here, I think, you know, this was a two-part recommendation on inspection and repair, and I think Christine's going to get into this, but there have been enormous achievements by NASA in the inspection imagery area, as well as enormous progress in the repair area. The difficulty in the repair area is that given the CABE report and the fact that they had listed the repair options at that time as high risk, NASA's inability to be able to certify and bring these repair capabilities to a better, I guess, validated state than they are today is the issue here. It's not that they have not done a great deal of work and have really developed a lot of very innovative products and potentials here that very well may work. It's just they have not been able to mature them to the state that we believe meets the CABE intent. Is that correct?
That's correct. The other part of the recommendation was the widest range possible. We didn't discuss that too much because we concentrated on capability or no capability. The range that if the five techniques that they're carrying were certified, they still cover a limited range of damage. Over the next several years, that will grow because they'll continue to work on it and come up with other options that will cover a wider range of damage. So they're well on the way to coming up with the capability, getting them certified, and we'll continue over the years to develop the range of damage that can be repaired. It's just at this time, on this day, I don't think that we can say that they're there.
Okay, substantial effort by the agency in going out and looking at repair of tile and RCC. We set a high standard relative to saying what they, our interpretation of the CABE recommendation was relative to the meeting intent, and based upon that high standard, the recommendation. And I applaud the tech panel and the operations panel for working through this one, because I know this has been one that has not been easy. And looking at what has been done and assessing it against this criteria, and bringing a recommendation forward, so I applaud you for that. But I think what I'm hearing is just what you say there: intent for repair has not been met, not because of any lack of effort or progress. I won't say it is progress to some degree because they haven't got to the certification through the certification process, but. Because of the high standard, the intent has not been demonstrated at this point.
That's correct, and I also want to say, it was very difficult because that those people put their lives into this for the last 2 years, and you really want to pat them on the back, so you guys did really good, and they did. It's just when you go back to looking at the literal words, it's hard to do anything other than this, even though the guys did a great job, and will continue to do a great job.
Okay. See, I would say, Dick, that the best brains of this country tried to solve an extremely difficult problem, and to this point haven't really identified a proven solution. Will they? I don't know. Will they keep trying? Sure they will. But if you just take a snapshot now of where are they, they just haven't been able to identify a high confidence way of repairing major TPS damage. And I think that was the intent of the CABE, was to have that capability when they launched.
I think the follow-on observation here is that is the encouragement that NASA rigorously can continuously follow that repair capability, develop it, mature it, and bring it to certification level as soon as possible.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, could we go back to chart 66? I'd like to make a fine point. Second bullet, in terms of risk mitigation, detection is quite different from being able to adequately respond to the detected damage. I think there's great value in understanding what is repairable and what is not, because repairing damage in itself can create more damage than good. And detection does have some risk mitigation capabilities in that you could decide to fly as is. And I think we have some information to be able to make that kind of decision.
That's a very good point and something I glossed over. It also has some risk mitigation in that there are some other operational things that can be done to make entry safer without doing a repair.
Exactly.
So that's a very good point. Thank you.
Okay. Keep us moving on here because we are under the clock. Are there any other comments or questions relative to the recommendation as presented? If not, I recommend, based on the closure package submitted by NASA, the op panel's presentation, our deliberation, the record reflect that the task group believes that NASA has not met the intent of the CABE recommendation as to repair, but has met it as to inspection, and that the task group will disposition this recommendation as such. And as I mentioned earlier, there was a minority position relative to the interpretation of the CABE recommendation, but based upon one that was accepted by the majority, we have agreement today that the intent was not met for that portion of the recommendation repair. Okay. All right. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Christine, and she's going to hopefully quickly take us through the...
Quickly, I have my charter. Next slide, please. Just to review, the task group decided early on to set up the Integrated Vehicle Assessment subpanel. The purpose of this panel is to look at how NASA is going to obtain and integrate the data from all of the additional cameras and sensors that they have added for STS-114 to directly support the complex decision-making required to address all the other things we've been talking about all along, particularly today. This is an effort that cut across many of the CABE recommendations, and members of management, technical, and ops were all assigned to support this subpanel, and I appreciate very much everyone's help in pulling this together. Next slide, slide 72. Next slide, please. Sorry. Okay, so in the past we've talked about the fact that SEIO, Systems Engineering and Integration Office, and Orbiter have been putting together a process to pull all this information together. The process to pull together all of the sources of the data, who's responsible for pulling the data together, assessing it, and then the timelines associated with pulling that data together were documented in the Operations Integration Plan. And we've talked about that in the past. Since we've last gotten together in the public forum, NASA has also put together what they're calling a Orbiter Damage Assessment Process Annex. This is the process by which they take the data that the OIP documents and pulls together and actually does the damage assessment. So this plan is very, very important. And so that was first rolled out late last year and then significantly updated and published in the last February in time to support MMT number 12. And then was refined again after MMT number 12. Fundamentally, the OIP and the damage assessment annex developers have significantly increased their training. They've broadened their participation, and they've put together an aggressive plan for this year leading up to launch to try to understand whether or not these processes are actually going to support the decision-making that's necessary. So they've done it in a stepped way. They've basically designed and implemented first what they call component sims, which takes pieces of either the OIP or the damage assessment process to pull together and understand it, and then they'll go and do what they call mini integration sims, which takes it to the next level and looks across different parts of NASA to see if they've got that together. And then finally, they roll that into a full MMT. And there were significant contributions of these developers, not just in the implementation of MMT number 13, the one that was just done in May, but also the design of that one. So fundamentally, this has become a very integral part of the decision-making that's been tested and worked through in the MMT series. Finally, I'd like to comment on the fact, that the OIP and damage assessment developers have done a lot of fact-finding trips all through this process to not just understand what's possible for NASA, but also what others do, how other people, how the military, how other sources of data can be integrated and independently assessed to support decision making. So they've looked outside just what they see in their own process to try to understand other processes. Next chart. There was a significant achievement very recently where actually NASA published the baseline version on April 12, 05 of both the OIP and its annex. This is an important recognition at the program level that this work has been created, vetted, and finally approved as work in progress. Next chart. So let me just offer some of our subpanel observations. First of all, the damage assessment annex has become a very important source of information on how NASA is actually going to support this complex decision that making that they're going to have to make with regard to whether or not repair is necessary, for example. It documents the sources of all the data that are necessary to support it. It actually talks about all the different tools that will be used to pull that data together to make the assessments. Actually includes risk versus risk assessment matrices, something that the task group in various ways has been talking about from the very beginning, how important it is to have risk assessment capabilities. This document actually pulls the data together, talks about the different kinds of risk. There was one that we just discussed about the risk between repair versus entering without a repair. That's covered in this document in one of these matrices. And as you just heard, it was the fact that they have this ability to pull this data together and assess it during flight has contributed significantly to the closure criteria for 641 with regard to inspection. The fact that they actually baselined this and NASA accepted it as a baseline version on April 12th is further evidence that NASA management continues to support this development, and we think that's very important that they continue to do so.